Welcome,
Dana Borgeson with the Whistleblower Newsroom. Celia, are you on the other end of the line there? Celia's still in Spain on personal employment.
I am. However, are you able to hear me?
Yeah, there's something wrong with the the sound on your end. So I'll talk about our guest, very special guest today, Gary Craig, who has been reporting, I mean, really is the reporter of record on what's going on with the Rochester Drug Cooperative case with the its CEO, Mr. Dowd, who is is being charged with basically being a drug dealer with the, you know, and helping to create, you know, fueling the opioid crisis with his company. But we'll let Gary tell you about that. Gary, are you on?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Could you just set the stage for us and tell us about this story and why it's so important?
Sure. So Rochester Drug Cooperative is a distributor of pharmaceuticals and obviously opioid products among those. It's based here in Rochester, New York, which is where I am. And it's been around for a long, long time. And unfortunately, like many of those in the pharmaceutical industry, it became almost like those who use the pills, I think, somewhat addicted to the profit, well, addicted to opioids, in that much of its profits in recent years and much of its success in recent years have derived from the sale of opioids to pharmacies. And as it turns out, a lot of those pharmacies were basically what, you know, were called pill mills, or at least some of them. I don't know if I can say a lot of them. Some of those pharmacies were pill mills, which were dispensing the pills with really out a lot of oversight and a lot of precautions. And RDC, when I say that, you know, shorthand for Rochester Drug Cooperative, RDC is supposed to keep records and alert the feds if they see these things, and for years and years they didn't. And so what basically happened was a week ago, earlier in the week, last week, they were criminally charged with, as you said, pretty much being a narcotics trafficking operation, as was its then or former CEO, Larry Dowd, and a compliance manager who has pleaded guilty to the crimes. And this is what sets this apart. This is the first pharmaceutical distributor to be criminally charged and the first executive to be criminally charged. And the timing so happens that the INSIS verdict came down in Boston yesterday, which were the manufacturers who were...
Now, talk about INSIS. You have to, explain who INSIS is to the audience.
Sure, and I'll tell you the truth, in the last sort of 6 weeks to 2 months, I've been getting a crash course myself, and I just when the RDC thing happened a week ago, I knew the outlines of the INSIS case, but not a lot of them. There's actually a frontline producer who was in town with the RDC thing, and we were chatting, and he'd been following the case. And INSIS is a manufacturer, and they were convicted of racketeering. So, I mean, if you take the RDC crimes and you take the INSIS crimes, I mean, we're talking about crimes that were originally conceived, racketeering with INSIS.
This is a huge, huge RICO case then.
It really is. And, you know, we're talking about crimes originally created for mobsters. And INSIS is a manufacturer. You know, their executives were found guilty of bribing physicians with kickbacks and other routes to just flood the market with the opioid products that they're creating. I mean, they had, you know, there's one instance where there's a doctor getting a lap dance from one of the salespeople. It's like a bad John Grisham novel when you hear this.
Oh, my God. So how, first of all, let's INSIS, this whole INSIS thing just happened. But how much money are we talking about with INSIS and with RDC?
Oh, geez.
I mean, how much money are we talking about?
I mean, tens if not hundreds of billions. I mean, RDC in and of itself, which is the sixth largest distributor of drugs, it's grown into that, and again, paralleling the opioid crisis, is $2 billion in and of itself annual sales, and that's one of the six largest, but it's still the ones that they're larger or significantly larger. And the manufacturers, you're definitely getting into the larger ones. They're the tens of billions of dollars. So it's clearly a major industry, and sadly, the growth in the industry in recent years has paralleled the opioid crisis, and you would hope it would parallel it in a way that they were trying to curb the opioid crisis, but instead it's really been exacerbating it in many ways.
Well, now we still don't know what the sentences are going to be for the INSIS executives, right? There's the CEO.
Right. No.
His name is Kapoor, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
And I caution as somebody, I cover federal courts a lot. I mean, that's really more what I do than anything. And I caution when you hear these, the reports, which are accurate, that he faces up to 20 years, that's accurate. But the federal courts operate under what's known as sentencing guidelines, which are the recommendations, which can be significantly lower than the max. So until we hear what those guideline numbers are, it's really hard to know what the sentence might be.
So Kapoor is guilty. It's John Kapoor. He's guilty of racketeering conspiracy charges. And then Richard Simon, the company's former national director of sales, is also been found guilty, as have Sunrise Lee and Joseph Rowan.
Both, yeah, Sunrise Lee is actually the former stripper who provided the lap dance, if I understand right.
Well, with a name like Sunrise.
Yeah. I guess if you're picking of the five of which one that was, that's probably where you would fall.
Anyway,
Sunrise,
the lap dancer, and Joseph Rowan were both one-time regional sales directors, and former vice president of managed markets, Michael Gurry. They're all, they're all on board for prison sentences.
Exactly.
But now, let's go back to RDC, because I noticed that RDC they have what's called a deferred prosecution agreement. What is that?
Yeah,
the company itself.
If I fall into the shorthand and say DPA, my apologies, but that's what it is. You see it with industries, and there's pros and cons. The cons will be the people say, oh, they're going to avoid having to have a conviction. I mean, basically, they're admitting to the crime.
I'm sorry, I missed that about the deferred prosecution agreement.
Okay. Oh, sure. My apologies. The people will argue that because of that, they're avoiding having a conviction. All these steps.
Now we truly have a sound issue. I can't hear you.
Oh, okay. Still there?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. Is that better?
Yes, that's better.
Okay, sorry. You're talking about the deferred prosecution agreement. What it means is at the end, if they follow these mandates of an agreement with federal authorities, there won't be a conviction. And those agreements are a $20 million fine. They're going to have an independent monitor who will report directly to the DEA, and there'll be independent members of the board. Now you could argue the argument that some will make was, are they getting off without a conviction? Is that really fair?
Now we're talking about the corporation. We're not talking about the CEO. We're talking about the institution itself.
Exactly. And you see these deferred prosecution agreements sometimes with the industries. And often, the federal prosecutor said in this case that if you give the company a conviction, that often will impede their ability to do business, just in many ways, whether it's licensing or things like that.
Well, why not impede their ability to do business? I'm going to say this, and you tell me what your response is. First of all, they were fined $20 million. $20 million is chump. It's less than chump change. That's like a penny that got stuck in the laundry, in somebody's back pocket for these people.
Oh, yeah, I'm not arguing with you there. When you're talking about $2 billion in gross sales, I don't know what the net is, but, yeah, $20 million is not a lot.
So why do you want to preserve an institution? Give me an argument for preserving an institution that has resulted in the deaths and addiction and lots of public money, cost the public, hundreds of millions of dollars or however much, with this opioid crisis. Why preserve that company?
Okay, I'll give you the argument, because I asked the same question of the feds, and I'll give you their response. And this is kind of the response, I think, when they agree to these, what are known as DPAs, is that if through the monitoring that they're forcing upon the company, they can get the company to act as it should, then you won't lose, the, in this case with RDC, the 200-plus jobs that are there. Yeah, that's, and so he says that the idea is that you can keep the business afloat, you can make it do the right thing, and you won't hurt the employees who were not the guilty parties. In the meantime, you're prosecuting separately the executives who you believe to be were responsible. That's the argument they will give you.
So they're preserving other people, they're preserving the jobs of these people. I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, aren't there other companies that do this, that do operate properly, that these people, I mean, it's just, to me, you take an institution that is so rotten, okay, mm-hmm. you help to preserve it, I think is a bad message to, other leaders of these companies, you know?
Oh, no, I fully understand, and I raise those same questions with the feds. I mean, I'm giving you their response. And it's, I mean, the jobs we're talking about, I mean, obviously there are executive jobs probably that may be reserved to people who are perhaps closer to all of this than they should have been. But at least I can talk of the Rochester operation. The bulk of the jobs that were preserved are the men and women who are working on the floor, you know, moving the pallets of goods, putting them on the trucks. Could they find work elsewhere? Possibly, yeah, I don't know. But that, when you look at least the 200 jobs, which isn't a huge number, but that's what it is here, that's going to be the bulk of them versus the executive-level folks.
Now, what about the pill mills themselves?
Well, that's, I mean, you know, we've been seeing prosecutions kind of all over the country to a degree. I wrote a story online today about a death out of New Jersey in 2016. And it's a death of a young woman, a 32-year-old opioid addict who was using Subsys, which was the NSYS product that, you know, led to the convictions yesterday. And her case has been known, it's been written about, and it's actually became congressional testimony. But we just figured out in the last few days, late last week, that the product that's used probably came through Rochester Drug Cooperative. So
oh
here
God.
you really have this. I mean, if you talk about the pipeline in its entirety, that it seemed to be pretty much corrupt at every stop along the way. You have the manufacturer, which was NSYS, which we now know to be guilty of racketeering crimes, you know, bribing physicians and other things, giving lap dances, et cetera, and sending the pills to Rochester Drug Cooperative, which was one of its distributors. And Rochester Drug Cooperative, we figured out, In the federal court papers against RDC, they talk about this thing, Pharmacy One, which was the largest client of RDC, and how RDC was just closing its eyes to all these clear warning signs that Pharmacy One, which is in Long Island, had been dispensing without hardly any safeguards opioid products, in particular this product, Subsys, which is what NSYS created. It's originally supposed to be just for cancer sufferers who are really in severe pain, and it basically made its way into the market broader than that. So the drug goes from NSYS, it goes to RDC where it's distributed. It's distributed to this pharmacy in Long Island, which we figure out to be a pharmacy named Linden Care, which is one that the RDC CEO, Larry Dowd, who has been criminally charged, had, according to court papers, a particularly cozy relationship, and his bonuses were dependent upon sales, and they made a lot of sales to this pharmacy. Then from there, those drugs go to a physician who's, you know, basically getting extra money for overprescribing the drugs, and they end up, sadly, with this woman, Sarah Fuller, who had terrible pains from a car accident and ODs shortly before her wedding.
Now, how much money was Dowd making? I mean, what was his base salary, and how much was he getting in additional in bonuses because of his high-selling drugs there?
It's, you know, and this, you have to remember, it's Rochester, so $1.5 million in Rochester is different than, say, $1.5
million.
That's
a lot of money, yeah.
Yeah, $1.5 million in Manhattan. And I think he's also, you know, had a place in Florida. But he, yeah, so $1.5 million was what he was doing. And that, had, I can't give you the specific breakdown, but I can tell from court papers that a decent percentage of that were the bonuses that were coming in his final years. I mean, it more than doubled his salary plus bonuses more than doubled, I think, over about a five-year period up until last year or so.
You think he'll be paying a fine?
I don't know. You know, it's hard to know. I mean, obviously he hasn't been convicted yet. And I mean, if he's convicted, the criminal charges, I mean, he's accused of narcotics trafficking and defrauding the government. That could include prison time. I mean, I assume there would be probably some restitution, too. There's a legal argument that kind of gets in the weeds that some have made to me that is sort of going a little bit beyond my probably knowledge base, but what the heck. That there is a federal statute about misreporting opioids if you're in these positions. You're failing to report and et cetera. And he's obviously charged with that. And what's going to be interesting is still if the statutes are flexible enough, the narcotics trafficking statutes, et cetera, to shoehorn those same allegations into. And some lawyers say it could be a test case for that. Obviously, the racketeering charges were flexible enough to get the INSIS folks yesterday.
Right. Right. Do you think that's going to inform Dowd's case?
I think it's hard to say. I mean, obviously, on the federal end, there's this move now to attack things criminally as well as civilly. They're not abandoning the civil actions, but obviously they're moving up the pipeline with criminal prosecutions more than what they used to. At the end of the day, it's hard to know if it's a jury. If they're aware of the INSIS case, through what's known as the voir dire process, prospective jurors may be excluded based on what they think of that. So it's
right.
Really hard to know. When you get it's a different world when you step into the courtroom with a case, and when you have the jury, it's hard to know what will inform what they decide at the end of the day.
So what I find interesting here is nobody is looking as far back as the FDA.
Yes.
There's
definitely been some allegations with the FDA and sepsis, and I'll be honest, I'm sort of learning about this as we go to a degree. Is whether the FDA kind of fell down on the job with sepsis. And just if I can talk a moment about sepsis, since we've been touching on it.
Yes.
Yeah. So sepsis is the drug that was really the foundation of the INSIS trial. INSIS created sepsis. It's an under-the-tongue spray for people. Originally, the idea was people who are really suffering some severe pain from cancer. It's a fentanyl product, and we know these days what fentanyl has done ever since it's gotten to the market. It's highly addictive, and this was in and of itself a truly highly addictive product. And sepsis, it made its way, sort of became more of a broader-based painkiller for folks who weren't. As I mentioned, the Sarah Fuller case, she had pains from an automobile accident, and physicians were prescribing this stuff. And if you go back and look at sort of the FDA, I think there's some real questions of what the FDA did and did not allow with substances that was being manufactured. That is something, to tell you the truth, I'm still sort of learning about as we go. I've been getting a crash course in some of this stuff over the last few months. We really started reporting on RDC about 5 months ago when we first got wind of the federal investigation. But I think you're right. I mean, I don't think you can exclude the FDA from this process, clearly.
Well, the interesting thing about the FDA, too, is they get most of their money from the pharmaceutical companies. So around and around we go here, right? I mean...
Well... That's the sad thing, and we talk about this sort of pipeline, is, in a rose-colored world, somebody along the way would be doing the right thing. And maybe that's too rose-colored. let's face it, the pharmaceutical industry should be doing good, and the regulators should be watching them to ensure they do good. But we're talking about them in terms of the laws that were created for narcotics traffickers and mobsters. And I think, and not just only the FDA, I think if you come back to the RDC issue here, the DEA, which is monitors these things, I mean, I'm sure their workload is excessive these days, but
yeah.
I think there will be some questions raised about the monitoring and how long did it take for the suspicions to arise when RDC, which was one of the nation's largest pill distributors, was hardly filing any what are known as suspicious order reports, which is when you notify the federal authorities that, hey, we're getting an order and it appears suspicious. And they only had four of these suspicious order reports over a couple of years, I think it was, which just seems, if anything, seems like it should be a warning bell. That's it.
Do you know the guidelines for a suspicious, I mean, when do you file one? What are the guidelines?
Well, there's a number of, you know, basically, if you're monitoring your, let's return to the distributor with RDC as an example, if they see, because they see some specifics from the pharmacy distribution of the meds, and there are a number of what are considered kind of warning signs that the pharmacies themselves may be pill mills, as we're talking about, or
right.
About physicians may be pill mills as well. But, and those are things like if you have a really high proportion of the orders are being made with the orders from the customers are being paid for with cash, if a lot of the orders are coming from out of state and other areas, pretty far distance, which means people are traveling beyond their, you know, probably the folks that know them to order the pills. And there's a number of these, this sort of checklist of things that if you see this happening, you're supposed to be monitoring, and then you file a report and you know, send it off to the DEA. And some of these things perhaps explanations for, but that becomes the job of the DEA to kind of, once they're alerted to it, to find out. But RDC had really just, and it, apparently there, you know, according to the criminal charges, there were internal warnings that, I mean, thousands of them, and at least with this pill mill.
Thousands of internal warnings?
Yeah, you know, I mean, several about saying you know, this could be a suspicious order, and as they moved up the line, they were getting nixed and not going to the DEA. And, you know, the feds argued that Larry Dowd was the one doing that. I guess he was CEO, but can he? And if he by himself is doing that, that just seems like a pretty strange hierarchy there to be set up.
Yeah,
but
the marketing people would be would be involved in that too, right? Because they want I'm sure their salaries go up and down based on their sales too, right? They get bonuses.
Oh, surely. And I mean, the interest thing, again, when I talked about being like a John Grisham novel, I mean, just beyond the, you know, the bizarre lap dance thing I mentioned, I mean, they had operations set up where when the insurers would call, you know, the insurers would call these operations and they would basically lie to the insurers about the reason for the prescription, you know, and, trying to get approval of it. And the marketing folks, you know, the marketing folks along the way were obviously, yeah, who knows how much they knew, but they were complicit in, to a degree in that of trying to get the doctors to buy into it. Just returning to the Sarah Fuller case for a minute, what happened with Sarah was she had some really bad auto accidents in the mid-2000s. Herniated discs in her neck, her back was really messed up. She went on, you know, she got prescribed painkillers, the OxyContin routine that a lot of folks went on. It just, you know, she put on a lot of weight. She had to give up a job where she was working as a nurse's aide, went on disability, and was weaning herself from this and actually had successfully, to her credit, weaned herself from the painkillers around 2014 or so, but was trying to find something else, you know, and was trying to find yoga regimens or something she thought would take care of it. And of course, according to her mother, there was a doctor that lived nearby where the family, or worked, her office was nearby where the family lived. And through a conversation, that physician said, I could take care of that. I could do that for her. And so Sarah and her father, Sarah was an adult, but she asked her father to come along, went to the physician's office. But not only did they meet with a physician, the INSYS sales representative was there when they showed up for the meeting. And basically to make the pitch for the product and to tell them, you know, claim that it was safe, claim that there's no issues, when it was one of the most highly addictive products out on the market. And so you have a physician who's allowing the marketing rep to be right there. You have a marketing rep who's obviously making the pitch to be there. I mean, the INSYS folks, you can go online and see this. They actually had a sales meeting, had a silly rap video by their, you know, some of their salespeople, so I don't know who it was, basically pitching how you can make sure that you sell more of this product and get it out in the marketplace. And it's truly disgusting when you watch it. It just makes you sick to your stomach to think that they're so uncaring about what was happening with this product that they wanted to sell so much they're creating silly marketing videos to motivate themselves to get out in the field and do wrong.
It's all about the Benjamins, baby. That's what it is.
Know, it really is, and you know, and that's the part that just. I mean, look, I'm a newspaper reporter married to a public school teacher, so I've never really understood it. but you know, but I,
You don't understand the Benjamins tribe, the ones that you know, they don't care. They have no moral compass at all. They just, it's all about making the money. I mean, that's, it's so pervasive in this society. This is why we have these massive corruption schemes going on in virtually every, you know, every arena you can think of, you know.
It's so true.
I mean,
and
who
and
needs... Go ahead.
Oh, no, I mean, I was going to say was I cover a lot, again, I cover federal courts, and I cover a lot of white-collar cases, and we've had our share of crazy white-collar cases here. And I cover drug dealers who cover their turf and do bad things, and I've always been more sympathetic to the latter than the former, because I can sort of see, to a degree, I know that they're, you know, a lot of them are struggling and all, just don't necessarily make it right. But most of the white-collar cases I've seen, it's been people who had tons of money to begin with, but still just didn't seem to have enough. And I've never quite understood, like, at what point do you decide this is enough? I don't need anymore.
Yeah. I call that the hungry ghost syndrome. It's, you know, the minute you're on that track where bigger is better and you have to have more and more and more, you can never have more. It's the illness of greed, but it turns you into a hungry ghost, you know?
That's a good, I mean, when I first got in the business many years ago, I was working in a small town newspaper, making probably $16,000 a year. And I'm from Winston-Salem, North Carolina originally, which was the home of R.J. Reynolds. And
right.
somebody with connections called me, and they said, I was young, I was probably in my early 20s or something. And they called me and they said, hey, you know, I've got a public relations job for you that'll pay you six figures. I'm sure I can get the job for you. And I was like, what? I'm making $16,000. And I said, well, with who? He goes, with R.J. Reynolds. I said, are you kidding me?
I know. And you know, the whole thing is, and that's why I'm really interested in seeing what happens, you know, what kinds of sentences these people get. Because the whole thing is that... People who adhere to certain ethical rules, you know, the basic rules of do unto others as you would want others to do unto you, and who lead their lives that way and work that way, do their jobs that way, are actually operating at a severe disadvantage to these hungry ghosts, you know, because they have no limits. And the problem is that you have enough corruption in the government, in the judicial system, that these people actually get up. Like this $20 million fine that RDC has, you know, it sounds like so much money to the general public, but it's literally a penny in their pocket. And to me, this is part of the problem, is that the punishments never fit the crimes. And it's all, I mean, to me, $20 million for RDC is barely a cost of doing business.
Yeah, if you're talking, again, I don't know the net. I've been trying to figure it out. But you're talking $2 billion in gross sales. And that's, I mean, if you look at RDC, I think it was, geez, I'm trying to remember. This is my own reporting. I'm already forgetting some of it. It wasn't that long ago. Well, yeah, about just 20 years ago that they were making $20 million grossing $20 million in annual sales, and which was good for them. I mean, it was a smaller business, and now they're up to $2 billion, and that can clearly be just aligned right along with the opioid epidemic, the growth over the last 15 years.
Well, that's how they made their fortune. They made their fortune hooking people on this stuff. By the way, Celia, are you there? Still, I don't.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, speaking of ghosts,
Celia
I've been
has
quiet.
A long.
I've
Celia
been
is
lurking
very...
like a ghost. Can you hear me? Christina, can you hear me?
Yes.
Christina, and okay. Can you hear me at a normal volume?
Yep, you're fine.
Perfect.
Yeah,
okay, great. I've been listening with fascination to this conversation. I'm really glad to jump in. My blood is boiling every time I return to this story and I look at these numbers before the show began earlier today. You know, I'm calling in from Spain, so sorry about the technical difficulties we had earlier, but I'm really glad we're all You can hear, you can still hear me, right?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
I can hear you fine.
So let's see. It's it's late afternoon here. The word, the crime. Let's talk about the crime for a minute, because the crime is so staggering. I don't know. I haven't checked these numbers, but if you just do a simple Google search, right, you come up with that 130 people die from opiate overdoses in the United States every single day.
Yep.
I checked the number for, it was from 1999 to 2015. The number of deaths was 568,699. The number in 2016 is 42,000. The number in 2017, almost twice that, 70,000. I mean, these are staggering numbers. And here's what I want to ask you, Gary, to move the focus a little bit onto just the media. I'm so interested in the fact that you don't have a background in pharmaceutical reporting per se, which is great. That was actually my background. Before I learned the hard way that's the toughest beat you can have is to try to report on and expose the pharmaceutical
that's why
industry.
I try to stay away from it. It's too confusing for me.
But you're a crime reporter, right? And so now you're the perfect reporter. You're a crime reporter, and these people are criminals, and we need crime reporters to stay on this beat, you know? And here's my question, and I'm finally getting around to it. I don't see any reflection in our national media about the size of the story. You know, the punishments don't fit the crime, but the reporting doesn't fit the story at all. It's just barely mentioned. What do you have to say about that?
So let me make sure I'm clear. When you're talking about barely mentioned, are you talking about the criminal element of it, or?
Oh, I mean the opioid catastrophe is barely mentioned compared to stories that aren't nearly as impactful on our nation get much bigger. Play, but here you have the equivalent of like an airplane disaster every single day, and it does get reported, but not to size, not for the catastrophe that it is. I feel.
I see what you're saying. I'll give a couple of answers, which may seem polar opposite, but hey, I'm a reporter. I fully understand where you're coming from. I think we were slow in the media to recognize the scope of, and we actually had some really good reporting here on the opioid epidemic from our health reporter, but I think we were slow in the media to recognize the scope of what was going on, and that's on us. I mean, I think that's really on us. I think we're playing a lot of catch up now. And similarly, you're right. It's because of the criminal cases. If you look at the last few weeks and the civil lawsuits, I mean, there's been states suing a number of these entities, including New York, along the way. But I was reading somewhere the other day, you can be in a group of whatever, 20, 30 people and ask the question, who knows somebody touched by the opioid epidemic? And typically half the hands are going to go up. They have a friend they lost, they know somebody's addicted or something. And I do think we in the media, and we're like this, and let's face it, we are, you know, the old, what was the movie Up, where the dog, every time the squirrel goes by, he chases and there goes squirrel and he's off and running. And we're sadly like that with the latest sort of catastrophe du jour. I do think there's actually been some really good reporting, though, from the national media of late on the topic, the Times and some others. Now, what I'm going to say, the where I was talking about something, the flip side, where I do get bothered as somebody who was reporting on the crack epidemic, that we didn't treat that the same way. I mean, the opioid epidemic, rightly, I think we've looked at the treatment end, the addiction end, in many, many ways. If you go back to the crack epidemic, the media reported on that was solely reported as a criminal epidemic. And largely, I mean, I personally don't think I'm alone in this, but would think there's a race-based issue there, that was largely hitting communities of color, and many newsrooms didn't know those folks.
I want to jump right in there. I think that it's a class issue. And I think that neither are getting the reporting that they deserve, really.
I have an interesting little insight into that because of my friend, DEA veteran Mike Levine. He did a very interesting test case for an idea he had, which was he said that because, you know, the drug dealing and so on in the cities and elsewhere was just getting so out of control, he went down to one of the southern states, I can't remember which one, and what he did was he had the cops not try to bust the drug dealers, you know, because all the drug dealers were in these poor, you know, black neighborhoods, right? He wanted the cops to bust the buyers. And the vast majority of the buyers were, guess what color? White.
Oh, yes.
So when that started happening, when they started to do that, man, it cleaned up like nobody's business. Why? Because these white folks, middle class, business class, whatever class, you know, certainly not poor, these people, you know, their names could not get out there in the paper or on the, you know, the criminal logs or rosters or whatever. I mean, they could not afford to have that. And so the whole thing just dried up because the buyers would not go there anymore because, you know, they weren't used to being arrested.
Yes.
And when Mike tried to make that into sort of a more national or a broader program, that was nixed too sweet, okay,
yeah.
Right away. So, you know, and to me, this also goes back to, you know, I mean, protecting RDC by only fining it $20 million and saying you're protecting these jobs for these people. But there's a sort of built-in, even these, I'll bet you anything, these people are going to get, they're not going to get 20 years. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
They're not going to get. They're not even going to get 10 years. How many years do you?
We'll see. Because okay, I want to introduce a whole other element to this. Where this pandemic has been going on for a long time, and it happened, as you pointed out, Gary, kind of came under radar, kind of crept up on us. I remember looking at a TV screen somewhere in maybe a doctor's waiting room, and I saw a figure about the number of people that had died from opiate overdoses, and it seemed like the story, like it didn't have public awareness campaigns attached to it, didn't have what I call a psyop, right? A psychological operation that was already working on you, so you understood what to be afraid of, and here it comes. There was none of that. It was just mass death and a queasy kind of understated reporting, I felt. Anyway, totally lost my train of thought now. Okay, yeah, here's what I want to say. I remember reading about a lawsuit about a year and a half ago, and all I remember, it was a politician, and I think he was in the Midwest, and he had put together a lawsuit, and it got into the real deep roots of this thing, where he proved that, or he was suing on grounds that the pharmaceutical industry had co-opted the whole ecosystem, but especially the doctors and the press, to create the lie, the false impression that opiates are not addictive, never mind deadly. Does that ring any bells with you, that what that lawsuit, where it went? And I'm sorry, I don't have the politician's name.
Well, no, but I mean, I can't speak to the lawsuit. I do, you know, I do think, and I'd really, it'd be interesting. Actually, you have me wanting to do this right now. I teach a class in our criminal justice department at a local university, and my students just submitted papers, and one of them was about the media coverage of the opioid epidemic. It was interesting. But you know, I would be curious to go back and look at the early days of the epidemic, because let's face it, there clearly was societally, I think, an acceptance of the painkillers. You go back to the hospitals and how a big problem was their quality of care scores that they were keeping track of, started including pain management. And so at the hospital level, there was basically a tolerance of accepting, you know, these prescriptions, et cetera. And I can't speak to it definitively, but I wouldn't be surprised if you went back to kind of the beginning days of this, if the media was in its own way complicit. I mean, we're sadly, sadly, we've been complicit in a number of things at the outset that we shouldn't have.
Well, here's what was in the ether. What was in the ether? In fact, I was asked if I would ghostwrite a book for a celebrity. This was about 7 years ago, and she was a pain patient, and she had to fight to get her pain meds. And the book was supposed to be, it's terrible what they're doing with pain medications. Legitimate pain patients can't get their meds. There was some tyrannical force out there trying to stop legitimate pain sufferers. And I just said, no, I don't want to write this book. You know, I don't think that's sorry, no. And I'm really glad that I didn't. That was a psyop. That was a sort of, you know, emotional story that was going around that you were supposed to respond to. Oh, these poor pain sufferers. Not the other side of the coin, that we're being way too promiscuous with pain pills. The reason I'm in Spain right now is because my son, who's 24 years old, fell off a mountain, smashed his leg. He's gonna be okay, thank God. This is interesting because he's had two surgeries, and he was lying at the bottom of this mountain for an hour and a half before the ambulance came. I can't say enough great things about the Spanish healthcare system. So he's pulling through. He's recovering from this, but he made a decision from the outset not to take a single painkiller, opiate-based painkiller, and he hasn't. And I mean, they used the word exploded to describe the bones when they looked at the X. This is a really severe injury, and it's going to be months before he can even consider putting weight on the walking or anything. So again, two surgeries. And he didn't take any pain, and even I and his father, you know, we were all saying, "Are you sure?" He has never gotten involved with them. He grew up in New York City, but he did lose one friend to this. But I don't even know where he got this from. I was grateful. I was worried. You know, are you sure you're not just going to pass out from the pain? But he knew. And so what the point of all this is to say. Another untold story is that the human body has mechanisms built in to address pain that people are never allowed to discover. You know, it's not fun, it's not easy, but things don't hurt the way we're brainwashed to say they're going to. You can have a tooth pulled and you don't need oxycodone, you know, so this is a cultural thing.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly, and my best wishes for your son, actually, in the recuperation.
People have a high tolerance for pain, and some people do not. So, I mean, I think that there are other ways to kill pain that are more natural and less destructive. I mean, you can't use your son as, I know, you know, I've gone through major surgery and I'm glad I had, you know, intravenous painkillers. You know, there's no way I could have slept or rested or
I don't know if
I go along with that.
But this is important for me. I'm not saying, oh, you know,
right.
Everyone has to be like he was. What I am saying is he wanted to choose to not be exposed to it in the event he became addicted and it destroyed his life. You see, and that's what I would like everybody to be told.
So you're talking about people are just conditioned to accept whatever pain pills are given to them.
It's handed to them, and then next thing you know, that thing has grabbed them, and nobody told them. This stuff is highly addictive. You could choose to suffer and not risk the addiction. That would be informed consent.
That's where I'm coming from. I'm not saying don't use medication, but I'm saying that I think for a while there was this quick willingness to sort of prescribe the strongest available medication and the most addictive medication in some ways. So.
I agree. You know, it's interesting because last November of 2018, New Jersey sued a pharmaceutical company. It's a subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson, and Johnson & Johnson is huge in New Jersey. And they brought legal, the company was called Janssen Pharmaceuticals, and they brought legal action against it, based on the spiraling opioid addiction crisis here in New Jersey, which is where I'm from. And, you know, it's interesting because now the states are starting to step in and deal with this because the federal, the feds are not. And apparently more than 40 state attorneys general have joined New York State in a multi-year, wide-ranging investigation of manufacturers and distributors of opioids. So, and 11 states, including New Jersey, have filed lawsuits against Purdue Pharma, who makes OxyContin. So, you know, there's a lot of aggressive pursuit of these companies now on the state level, because, of course, the states are picking up the cost of dealing with the side effects, obviously.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Purdue, because what was your great term again about the greed? What ghosts? What was that again?
What, the hungry ghosts?
Hungry ghosts, thank you. Because so, if you go back to Purdue you know, Pharma and the Sackler family, I don't know, 10-plus years ago, you know, they did have a settlement acknowledging that, you know, they had not really recognized the addictive qualities of some of the medications. And you would think, again, that in and of itself would have said, okay, let's be cautious and careful and, you know, concerned with what we do. But instead, we're right back to where the states, you know, New York and others are suing the Sacklers and the company because of what we've seen in the 10, 12 years since that settlement.
I read online that fentanyl is 50 times stronger than heroin and
yes.
100 times, wait, what was it that was 100 times more potent than morphine? Is that right? Not sure if that's exactly right. But what I'm wondering is, I mean, this seems to me like the devil's invention here, fentanyl. Why was it necessary to come up in the first place with a pain medication 50 times stronger than heroin?
Well, because I mean, you want to create a market base. You want to create a base of consumers.
This stuff, it sounds like everybody is one pill or one spray or one whiff away from death. This I want to talk to a little bit in the remaining minutes if you know about this, Gary.
From death or
all
addiction.
These deaths,
addiction
are they from
worse.
People who overdid it or took like maybe just like slightly over? It seems really easy to die from this stuff.
Oh, no, I think it's a combination. I mean, I can I say what percentage are addicts? No, but I do think, you know, a decent percentage of people who had grown addicted to it from multiple uses. But there have been cases of people whose just sort of constitution could not handle what the drug did to them. And, you know, and it was not long after they imbibed the drug that they were gone. And it's just really, really. And then there's, of course, illicit versions of fentanyl that are hitting the black market just in sort of lower income communities and are sold on the street just like heroin used to be.
And just to give you an example, in New Jersey, there was some preliminary data showing that in 2017, there were 2,750 overdose-related deaths, okay? So, but I think that ideally what manufacturers of highly addictive drugs, I mean, besides, you know, you deal with the pain, but you can also create a lot of continuous consumers, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, a good drug dealer is always looking for a...
Some of the court cases, there were records that showed that was the goal, to create a continuing base of consumer. That the idea
wasn't... Wait, what did you just say?
I mean, I forgot which court case, but there were documents that basically said, I can't remember if it was INSIS or what, that there were internal documents to that effect that basically said, you know, this is how we can create a continuing base of consumer. My apologies for not remembering which of the multiple cases. It wasn't RDC, I know that, but it was one of these other national cases, that at least there was a memo internally about how to do that. You know,
there was a pharmaceutical
Christina,
company
that's their whole
internal
business
memo.
Model. That's their whole business model. That should not shock you. That's their business model. It's not to solve someone's problem and let them go. It's to enslave them for life.
Yeah. After all these years of covering criminals, I still hope for somebody to do the right thing, but I should know by now.
No. Don't do that. Don't do that because, you know, if you look at the history, informs you that that is not the case. That's why the laws and the punishments need to be upgraded to fit the crimes. I mean, because if you look at this, you've got you have the maker, and then you have the marketeers, and then you have the pharmacy
media,
and then you have the doctors. So how many people are we talking to that are related even to this INSYS, RDC, you know, and further down to the pharmaceutical company, to the pharmacies, and how many people are we talking about here?
Oh yeah, I mean, I can't quantify it, but you just hit every touch on the pipeline. Again, with that case that I wrote about, Sarah Fuller, you start with INSYS, you know, illegally marketing this product that's highly addictive. It goes to Rochester Drug Cooperative, which is, you know, their CEO's getting bonuses based on how much they're able to distribute to pharmacies. It goes to a pharmacy in Long Island, which they're seeing just incredibly excessive numbers of this drug going out, but they're benefiting from it, which is a whole other process there, how they were benefiting financially. Going to a physician who's possibly getting kickbacks, and then in the hands of the person suffering from severe pain who ends up addicted and dead. I mean,
It's extraordinary, and I truly believe that the institution's money, I mean, I think they should sell the institution and give that money to all the states or the areas that have been afflicted by the addiction and death that you know this pipeline has created, so that you know people can start cleaning up this mess. I don't see why those institutions should remain. You know, yeah, you're saving 120 jobs, but you know, how do you think, you know, that the regular, you know, taxpayer has to pay to clean up all these messes in all these different states and counties and areas where these people are dying or addicted, and all the crime that arises as a result? And law enforcement is always, I mean, I don't know anywhere where law enforcement isn't slammed up against the wall because they're short of funds and whatever, you know?
Resources. True here. No, that's I'm with you there. It's law enforcement's always struggling to just try to keep up with whatever.
They can't. And it just seems unfair that the institution is protected, you know, with just a minor $20 million fine. And then it can go along its merry way, while the havoc that has been wrought is just, you know, no money going there in the aftermath of all this, you know?
You know, just it was kind of a here on our local front with it, beyond the RDC issue, but more just sort of the local, we like every community is dealing with this, with overdose deaths, et cetera. And the treatment community here was responding, but in this sort of kind of bureaucratically slow way. You know, everybody was in their own silo, and it actually was the law enforcement community, you know, some of the leading law enforcement folks here that finally said, wait, you know, come on, folks, let's start answering this crisis. I mean, you know, the law enforcement community had to basically push the treatment community here to really get things moving and to get extra beds, et cetera. I mean, they were moving toward it, but they were moving at this glacial pace, which was nowhere near keeping up with the epidemic we were seeing.
Well, is it how hard is it to wean somebody? Is it even possible to wean somebody off of these things? I mean, how hard is it to wean them off? If you're addicted.
I mean, I think it can be done. I mean, I've been years ago when I was writing about the war on drugs, and like the media, you know, we thought we had a solutions package. Obviously, we did very well there. But I mean, I spent back before HIPAA. You know, I spent time in a treatment facility there, just watching and interviewing people day after day after day, and I assume it's like heroin. I saw people who beat heroin. You know, it's an opioid product.
Wow.
It wasn't easy, and you know, and watching them go through it was brutal sometimes. But they beat it, and they're clean to this day. So I assume it can be done, but it's not an easy process.
Yeah, and it's a long process, and it's an expensive process.
Oh, very true.
To tell our listeners, we're coming to the close of the program. We've been talking to Gary Craig, a veteran investigative reporter, does such great work. He's with the Democrat and Chronicle in Rochester, New York. He is the winner of national investigative awards for his reporting on wrongful conviction, author of a book called 7 Million, which is about one of the largest armored car robberies, and it's links to the IRA. Gary, where can people find you? What is your, for example, Twitter handle?
Twitter is gcraig1, the number one, G-C-R-A-I, I think I can spell my own name. Let me try that again. G-C-R-A-I-G-1. I've never looked up who G. Craig without the one is, but I'm G. Craig 1.
G. Craig 1 on Twitter. Okay, excellent. Yeah, do you think your editor is going to keep you on this story? I certainly hope so.
Oh, I'm going to stay on it. I'm staying on it. That's my choice. But yes, I mean the difficulty is I'm in Rochester, and the criminal case is in Manhattan, and most of the world thinks New York is just New York City. But I'm 6 or 7 hours away from New York City, so that's kind of the difficulty. But I've been able to so far keep good lines of communication with many attorneys and others involved, and that's actually how we got this story today. I tracked down through court records linking that death, and then the attorneys who handled the civil case were all very helpful with me as far as sort of bringing me up to speed on what was going on in a case in New Jersey that's obviously out of my.
Quick question, do you think that are the families going to be suing now, or are we going to see a tsunami of family-initiated lawsuits?
Oh, I think, we're starting to see some. I mean, I think we definitely will. It's going to be, it's almost like you're talking earlier with the precedent criminal cases here. It'll be interesting to see the outcomes and whether that will start more, but I think we're definitely going to see some of those.
Let me ask you something real quick. Who blew the whistle on RDC? And who blew the whistle on INSIS? Who blew the whistle on these guys?
Apparently it was INSIS. There was a whistleblower some years ago who alerted some authorities, and started the process going, particularly I know there's some news coverage out there I remember seeing about it. RDC, I don't know. I mean, whereas I talked earlier about the DEA monitoring, I do think this may have been caught some by them sort of seeing this lack of suspicious orders being marked. And they had a settlement a few years ago with RDC, a smaller settlement, in which I think alerted them to this issue that they needed to keep an eye on them. So I if there have been whistleblowers at RDC, I haven't heard about it, and I've talked to a number of people. It does seem like the regulators, at least caught up to the problem here and intervened.
Maria Guzman did INSIS. She was a sales rep. Maria Guzman, thank you.